I might not even need this thing. Darwin alcoholic. Grateful to be sober. It's a privilege for me to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you, Mark, for inviting me. I have a sobriety date of September 9th, 2001. That means last Monday I celebrated 23 years. By the grace of God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I would like to tell you, well, I have done some things. I followed the direction of my sponsor. His name is Larry Thomas. He's my second sponsor. My first sponsor was a guy named Peter Fleischman. Some of you might know him, have heard of him. He died in 2009 with liver problems. And then I immediately asked one of his sobriety brothers to be my sponsor because I wanted to stay in the same genre of AA. I found out that what we are is fundamentalists. I love the fundamentalists. I love doing it the old way. My home group is called Over the Bridge. We meet on Thursday nights. We invite people to come in and share their experience on the steps or traditions. So last night we had a woman come in from the Los Angeles area, and she talked about her experience with steps 1, 2, and 3. Next week we'll do 4 and 5, and we rotate through the steps and the traditions of the steps and the traditions. And the best part is we get 20 to 30 minutes to ask them questions. We call it Stump the Drunk. Sometimes it works. I love the question part myself. Christian, thank you for driving. We left my house at 1:15. We got to the restaurant at about 6:10. And I just had to sit there and talk. And what I like the most about being in the car with Christian, and we both feel pretty much the same way about other drivers. It was very good for both of us. I'll be 75 a week from tomorrow. So I got sober just before I turned 52. Because I'm not a quitter. And I spent many years drinking, amassing evidence that I wasn't an alcoholic. I never got a DUI. I never went to jail. I went to work every morning. The rent was paid. There was money in the bank. I didn't lose any relationships. I had all this evidence that I wasn't an alcoholic. And when I shared that with my first sponsor, he said, "Darwin, virgins don't buy pregnancy tests. Only an alcoholic would be looking for evidence that they weren't an alcoholic." But because I didn't experience some of the consequences that some people experience from drinking, I couldn't be an alcoholic because I thought alcoholism was the consequences. And then I found out, I love that first paragraph, and we agnostics. If when you start drinking, you have little or no control to the amount you drink, or when you try to stop entirely, you find out you cannot, you're probably an alcoholic. It's like, that's me. I knew that if I started drinking, I couldn't stop. I could not drink, but I couldn't stop drinking once I started. So I was born in the late 40s in a little town in Utah. So I was raised LDS. Spent the first 18 years there, and I can remember as a four-year-old being in kindergarten, and we're going up to ride the slippery slide, and Leanne Hansen is in front of me, and I can see her panties and her little poopy spot, and I don't know what occurred up to that point, but I knew that I shouldn't be looking there. That I was unacceptable, that God was going to find me less than, that there was something bad about me because I did that. And I started a long story that I lived in about God finding me unacceptable. And I lived in a very religious community, you guys. It was all about God. And I started backing away. Because God found me unacceptable. And I kept creating piece of evidence after piece of evidence after piece of evidence that I was right, that God found me unacceptable. I can remember as a kid, They're talking about, you know, the things we do, the good things and the bad things. And we're going to get up there and St. Peter's going to bring out the book and you're going to have the black marks and the red marks. And I just picture God's got everybody lined up. Hitler's all the way over here to the right. Mother Teresa's all the way over here. And he's walking down the line and he says, everybody here forward's going to have hell. And I'm right there. And he leans forward and he says, Darwin, you stole one too many cookies. That was my relationship with the higher power before I got sober. I grew up in Utah. Dude, you had to go to the state-owned liquor store to buy booze. Remember being in graduating high school, four of us decided to go to a drive-in movie. One of the guys was old enough to buy beer. He bought a six-pack. There were four of us. So I drank three. The other guys each drank one. I didn't think anything was wrong. No big deal. Went home. It was three beers. One night, my buddies and I decided we're going to drive. Logan is about 16 miles from the Utah-Idaho border, and in Idaho, you could buy booze. So we drive across the border. I get a half a pint of something. And we're driving back, and we're drinking, and this highway patrolman goes by, and we all freak out, and we throw our booze out the car door, out the window. I'm the only one that wanted to turn around and go back and get it. I didn't like being in Utah. It didn't, the lifestyle didn't meld with the way I was living. And so I moved to Los Angeles, slept on my sister's couch. I was 18 years old. And I got a job in a carnival where we were in a different city in California every week. And on the edge of where the carnivals are in every town, on the edge of town, there's always that little bar where I could go in and I could get a pitcher. But I didn't dare drink more than a pitcher. I would leave and I would come back because I ran this dart game where they have balloons and darts. And down the middle of it is where we kept our stuffed animals. And there was a bed and that's where I slept. And I came back one night and all the guys who ran the rides were all standing in a circle. There was about 8 or 10 of them. And they're standing in a circle and they're passing around this bottle. And it gets to me and I take a big swig of it. I can't tell you what it was. All I know is I took a big swig of it, the bottle goes around, take another big swig, that bottle's gone, somebody gets another, it goes around. And for the first time in my life, I get drunk. I finally have enough alcohol to know that I've changed things. Things are different. For the first time in my life, I'm comfortable with this group of people. I don't feel like they're judging me. And I'm stumbling, and I don't care. And I go to my bed, and I puke, and I piss the bed, and I get up in the morning, and it's like whatever, it's one of those was bourbon, one of those is rum, don't mix your drinks. The next time I had a chance, I met some people that were, I was in the carnival, go to their house to party, we're drinking gin. Again, I get drunk, I get blacked out, I wake up in the morning, passed out on their couch, don't drink gin again. It's never was the way I drank, it was always about what I was drinking. Thank you for the water, you guys. Nice and cold. So the summer I was 18, I was working at a carnival. Carnival ends, I go home. I'm now 19 years old. When you're 19, you can go on a mission if you're a Mormon. So they decided to send me on a mission. So the summer I was 19, I was a Mormon missionary in Kentucky and Tennessee. And I kept stealing the mission car, driving to the bus chase and going up to New York. I kept running away from my mission. And I'd go back to my mission, I'd run away, go back to my mission, I'd run away. Finally, the third time, I'm thinking I'm done with this. And they never asked me why I left. And so I go to the mission president and I say, do you ever wonder why I leave? And he goes, because you've never asked me. And he goes, okay, why do you leave? And I said, well, I get horny. And he says, well, you don't do anything about it, do you? I'm like, well, yeah. And they kicked me out. Had I known, I would have told him a long time ago. I'm a guy that's constantly looking for evidence that the rules don't apply to me. Okay? When I found out that I could go to the university without a high school diploma, I didn't graduate from high school. I got a GED later. When I found out I could go to a state-run university without a high school diploma, I got ticked off. Because all through school, it's like, you'll never be without a high school diploma, you'll never be anything, blah, blah, blah. So, another piece of that, I go in the Navy. Oh, 18, I'm at Carnival. 19, I'm a Mormon missionary. 20, I'm in the Navy. I'm a hospital corpsman in the Navy. And I turned 21, so I joined the Navy in March. That September, I turned 21 years old. I get assigned to Oakdale Naval Hospital up across the bay from San Francisco. I get there 3 days after I turned 21, and the first thing I do is take a bus over to San Francisco and start looking for bars. And when I graduated from boot camp, I was the company scholar. I had the highest grade point average of anybody in my company. When I graduated from hospital corps school, I was in the top 10. And then I start drinking, and all of a sudden, I'm AWOL. I forget to go to work the next morning. So that would have been the spring of 71, okay? So by the time they kicked me out of the Navy in October of 1972, I've been in front of the Admiral. They do these things they call Admiral's Mask because they used to mete out punishment. In the sailing ships, they would mete out punishment at the mast. And so you go in front of, they call it captain's mast. And after you see him three times, they give you a verbal warning that if you're in front of them again for your fourth captain's mast, they're going to give a written recommendation that you get discharged out of the military with a bad conduct discharge. And if you go in front of them the fourth time, then the fifth time you're in front of them, you get discharged with a bad conduct discharge. Well, they finally discharged me out of the Navy on my 13th captain's mast. They had to give me an honorable discharge because my quarterly marks were above a 3.2 because I'm a really good worker. I don't like to iron my uniform. I don't like to polish my shoes or my brass or cut my hair. I don't like to do any of that military stuff, but I like work. I'm a good worker. Another piece of evidence that the rules don't apply for me, and it's just the beginning of me finding more evidence and more evidence. It's some of that. It's that mindset that I lived in, that I'm not an alcoholic. I'm always looking for a piece of evidence that the rules don't apply for me. I've never had a DUI. I can't be an alcoholic. Okay? And fast forward, I've started a very lucrative business. I cut hair for a living. I own my own salon. I'm always there to take care of my clients. Well, so the 70s, it was cocaine, weed, cocaine, black beauties, little PCP once in a while, you know. So I leave San Francisco and move down to San Diego because it's cocaine. And I get down to San Diego, and I if you're going to do those kind of substances, you don't pay full price. You got to sell them. Because that's the way you do it. They'll be stupid. And so in the 80s, it was meth. I shot meth for 5 years from 1980, well, almost 6 years, 1986. Half a gram a day And I knew I couldn't go to beauty school tweaking on meth, so I put the needle down. I never picked it up. I picked up a bigger bottle of vodka. Two months after I put the needle down and picked up the bigger bottle of vodka, I'm coming out of a blackout and I'm urinating over the dirty dishes in the sink. And the woman I was in a relationship with at the time was yelling, calling me a pig. And I'm like, I'm a pig? Look at the dirty dishes. Yeah. And she takes her son, it was just like, that boy and I would, every day, him and I would take the dog for a walk. And I would smoke a joint, and when I started, I would get a pint or a half pint of vodka to drink on the walk, and it got to be a bigger bottle when we started doing that. And she took her son, Ryan, and she said, "I'm going to go sit in the car, and I'm not coming back in the house until you leave." And I loved those two people enough that I left the house, and I stopped going to beauty school for about a month, got my stuff together. And started a very lucrative business in drinking. I promised myself that if my drinking ever affected my ability to take care of my clients, I would have to do something about my drinking. Now, the time that Chris started stopped coming to get his haircut with me, because in a blackout, I was berating some of the women that were working next door. You don't even want to know that story. That didn't count. So I'm starting to drink more. I wake up at home. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. I've got this little chocolate colored chihuahua, and I looked up the covers, and Charlie is there, so we're okay. And I get up and I go to work, and I'm not going to drink that day. But this wine store down on the corner, they have the coldest sodas of downtown. And I'm going to go down there. I'm going to go get a cold Coca-Cola. And I walk in, and I go to back, and I get my Coke, and I come and put it on the counter, and he's got my bottle of Kettle One sitting there. And my head is like, you're not going to drink that. And I don't want to tell him I don't want it. And I buy it, and I'm walking back to the salon. And my head is saying, you're not going to drink. You said you weren't going to drink today. You're not going to drink. And I'm walking, and I go to the back room, and I'm taking the lid off, and my head's like, what are you doing? You said you weren't going to drink. I've been having trouble with waking up at home, not remember closing the salon, not remember closing the bar, not remember walking 3.5 miles home. So I'm not going to drink today, because it's getting hard. It's getting hard to look at the way I'm drinking. But I'm not going to drink. And then I pour a tumbler, and the voice says, tomorrow, we'll do it tomorrow. And I come out of a blackout one more time, and what I remember is my landlord, Kurt, telling me that I had 60 days to move my salon. And there's this big thing downtown San Diego called Street Scene. And my business was right in the middle of it, and they put fence up all the way around, chain link fences up. There's going to be 5 different bands, stages for bands, and there's food, and you have to buy a ticket to get in, and it's just thousands of people out on the streets, and if you have an appointment to get your hair done, I can get you a ticket. You don't have to buy it. And my clients would come down, and they'd come to the salon, and they'd bring their cases of beer and their bottles of wine and their bottles of booze and their mirrors and their razor blades. And I would put a little thing on their wrist so that they could come in to use the bathroom. They didn't have to use the porta potties. And that's Street Scene. And I wake up on Friday morning, September 7th, and I remember Kurt saying, I have 60 days to move my salon. And I'm like, go to work. And I'm telling the women who work next door. And Kurt has 3 storefronts downtown in the Gas Lamp and beautiful old buildings. And he has 3 antique stores. And my salon is in the back of one of the antique stores. And I start telling everybody, Kurt told me I got 60 days to move the salon. And they're like, oh, Darwin, you know, what you pay him for your rent pays the rent on all these 3 storefronts. He's not going to kick you out of here. He can't afford to kick you out. You pay all his rent. Just chill. And then my friend Meg and Randy come, and they're like, come on, let's go have lunch. And they're like, let's get a pitcher of beer. And I'm like, no, I can't drink, because I knew if I start drinking, I'm going to keep drinking. I knew I wouldn't stop drinking. It was noon. I'm not going to stop drinking just because I'm going to keep drinking. And I have some beer. And the next thing I know, it's 2:30 on Saturday morning. And I come out of a blackout again. And Kurt's saying, you remember that I told you you have to move your salon? I'm like, yeah. And thanks, bud. I'll make it easy for you. And come out of a blackout again. Kurt's saying, remember, you got to move. My friend Patty's there. She's like, come on, Darwin, I'll give you a ride home. It's 2:30 in the morning. I walk over, and all there is to drink is gin. And I don't care. I need a drink. And I make me a drink, and we walk up to where Patty's car is. She takes me home. I've got a client coming in at 9 o'clock the next morning. I cannot not show up for my client. I go to bed, I wake up, I shower, I shave, I walk down to the salon, and I put my key in the door, and the door won't unlock. And I'm like, oh crap. He's locked me out. I'm not going to be able to take care of my client. My drinking has taken me to a place where I won't be able to take care of my client. And it's Sandy. And Sandy has been my haircutter client every 4 weeks for 6 years. And I can't take care of, and there's a note on the door that says, Darwin, call Kurt. And I take my phone out and I dial Kurt's number and it rings and it rings and it rings and it rings. And it just keeps ringing and it goes to voicemail. And I try it again and it goes to voicemail. And these beautiful buildings, you know, where the glass is beveled and there's wood at the bottom where they put the mail slot is, and I'm down on my knees, and because he slept up in the back of one of the stores, and I'm down on my knees and I'm yelling, trying to get him up to come and let me in so I can take care of Sandy, and he's not coming down. And my friend Leslie had been worried about, she's one of the people that was talking to me about my drinking. And she would go on a regular basis, she'd go up to the VA hospital in San Diego and visit a friend of her mother's who was in the VA with a wet brain, and she's talking to me about how she's afraid I'm going to have a wet brain. And that if I don't stop drinking, that's going to happen to me. And my friend Teresa says, you know, I love you, Darwin, but if you're going to drink, I'm not going to go out with you anymore. We can go out, we can go do stuff, but if you're going to drink, I can't spend time around you. So for the first time in my career, I've got people talking to me about the way I drink. And Kurt's not answering the door. And Leslie had given me the business card of this guy that was a therapist. There's a treatment center down in San Diego called Rancho Labrie. It's really funny because the guy that owns it, his partner's family is the Sauza tequila family. And he took their summer home just over the border from Mexico and turned it into an alcohol treatment center. So I'm calling Len, and Len's not answering the phone. And I'm like, what am I going to do? I need some help. And I'm sitting on the curb and I'm crying because it's like, oh, crap. I finally have to look at the way I'm drinking, and I'm just like freaked out and I'm crying. And Sandy walks up and she says, what's the problem, Darwin? And I said, I think I have a problem with alcohol. And she says, I know. Like, shit. So finally, I don't know that I'm eligible to go into the VA hospital. I'm a Vietnam era veteran. I don't know I can go to the VA hospital treatment for free. And I start borrowing money from some friends. So I borrow $7,000 to go into Rancho Labrie. And so I finally check into Rancho Labrie. So I go to sleep Saturday morning. They go down to the salon to take care of my clients. I wake up Saturday afternoon. I open up the refrigerator, and the bottom of the refrigerator is filled with cold Heineken. And my head says, do you want one of those? I'm like, yeah. My head says, no, you can't drink anymore. And I look over on my desk, and there's my little container of skunkweed, that real stinky, sticky skunkweed, and my little prototype. And it's like, do you want some of that? And I'm like, oh, yeah. Because at that point, I'm just drinking and smoking. And I didn't drink in the morning because I got stoned every morning. Because only alcoholics drink in the morning, and I don't drink in the morning because I'm not an alcoholic. I get stoned instead. And I said, you want some of that? I'm like, yeah. And then the voice says, if you drink that, if you smoke that, you'll drink that. I'm like, they're right. And I go back to sleep. I wake up on Sunday. We make arrangements for me to go into Rancho Labrie. So Sunday is September 9th. That's why September 9th is my sobriety date. It's the first day I did not put a substance into my body. So I finally check into Rancho Labrie on the 10th, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, September 10th, 2001. And they say, how long has it been since you had a drink? And I tell them, and I'm like, oh my God, here's 40 milligrams of Valium. You better take this right away because they're afraid I was going to have a seizure. Da-da-da, we get wake up. The next morning is September 11th, 2001, and the towers have come down. And they won't let us watch TV because they're afraid we're going to get triggered. We finally get them to turn the TV on. So I spent 30 days in the treatment center. We come to the end of the treatment center and they say, you know, Darwin, you have a 16% chance of staying sober now that you're physically separated from alcohol. You need to go into a recovery home. I'm like, you don't understand, I have to go to work. I'm like, no, you need to go into a recovery home. He said, you don't understand. If I lose my clients, I have no reason to stay sober. So they found me a place called 1111 Island. It's where all the homeless people go to get sober. So I leave this high-end treatment center and go into the free government bed, county bed, into 1111 Island Street. And it's 5 blocks away from my salon. So I can go to work every day and start taking care of my clients. Because if I lose my clients, I have no reason to stay sober. That's what 30 days. But I did understand that 60% chance of staying sober with separation, 35% chance of staying sober if I go into a recovery. I'm a numbers guy. I'll do this as long as I get to take care of my clients. So I start taking care of my clients, and I have to be back at the recovery home by 5:45 every day. So I've got to mark out in my calendar. So my calendar gets, so I'm taking care of clients every day of the week because I've got to be back to recovery home. And then we had to go to meetings, and we'd have to get our slip signed. And I realized that I'm going to meetings to get my slip signed. I'm not going to meetings for any other reason. I'm going to get my slip signed. I don't care. And if they'll sign my slip and let me out the door, I'll go get my slip signed and I'll leave. I just want to keep my bed so that I can go take care of my clients. I'm paying rent on an apartment 2 miles away. And then there's this guy comes in. They had a Wednesday night speaker meeting there. And this guy came in. Nice shirt, slacks. His hair was clean. He was shaved. His eyes were shining. And he passed a picture around of himself from 8 months earlier. And his beard was down to here. And there was food stuck in it. And his fingernails were 3 inches long. And his eyes were dead. And he stood up at a podium like this. And he said what he did was go to AA. And I'm like, I don't need to be in this place. I need to go to AA. And the next day was Thanksgiving. My mother had died when I was 60 days sober. They'd let me go visit, see her before she died, go to the funeral. And I left out a really important part of the story, you guys. 2 weeks into the recovery home, in the treatment center, I called Kurt because I'm going to be in here 30 days. That means I got another 30 days to move my salon. I called Kurt. He's like, I know where you are. Don't worry about it. You're good. Then he tells me that after I left the salon, he went and got his truck, brought it back and parked it in front of his shop, went and opened the door, went the back to get something that he needed to take to storage, and he came out and somebody had stolen his keys. And he was there till 5:30 in the morning getting the keys changed for the shop, for his car, for everything. And his employee's name was Lee. Now, Lee and Kurt didn't have it together financially to be able to get a cell phone. So Lee's girlfriend set them up with cell phones on her plan. And they had identical cell phones. And Lee and Kurt got their cell phones mixed up. So I'm calling Kurt, and Kurt's phone is over at Lee's house. And Lee isn't going to answer it because he thinks it's Kurt calling him to come back to work. Somebody stole Kurt's keys. I wasn't locked out. The sign was on there so that Kurt could tell me that from then on, I wasn't allowed in the building after 6 o'clock at night. There would be no drinking. There would be no smoking. All I could do was come and take care of clients, and I had to move. Somebody stole his keys. They got their phones mixed up, and I ended up in the treatment center. And I'm 2 weeks without a drink. And I've had this relationship with the higher power as a kid. And the only thing that I can think of is that something had intervened in my life. Something had set things up to force me. I used to say that God put me in a room, knocked out the doors and windows, greased the floors, and tipped me into, and I slid into AA. It's the only reason. And this guy says, all I got to do is go to AA. So the next morning, I pack up my stuff. and I tell the guy that's in charge of this, the sober, the recovery home, the VOA, Volunteers of America. And he said, "You're drunk. You don't even know yet." I'm like, "I'm going to go to AA." I went to find a meeting that day. I couldn't find a meeting. It was Thanksgiving. I wasn't looking in the right places. I finally found a meeting Sunday morning. It was a 2-mile walk from my house. There's a men's recovery home called Pathfinders. It's been around forever. It was started by alcoholic men who wanted to create a safe space for men to come off the streets and detox. And over time, the county started giving them, the city, and then the county, and then the state, and then the government. And it turned into this thing that's not quite what it was when I first started. And I'd go to this meeting. It started at 9 o'clock on Sunday mornings. And I start walking over there on Sundays. And then I find out that my friend Brad lives between me. And so I'd stop and pick Brad up. He just got out of the treatment center. I pick him up. We'd go over there. And we'd stand outside the door, because it was standing room only. It was just jammed with men that were sober. And we'd get there at 9 o'clock when the meeting started. And we couldn't get a seat. We couldn't even get in the door. So we'd stand outside at the door and just watch the meeting. And then this guy comes out, and there's all these people are standing around him, and they're laughing and they're having a good time. And he says, "We used to listen to his tapes. Those tapes that we listened to in the men's room, that's him." He's like, "I want him to be my sponsor." And I'm like, "Come on." Actually, his name was Chad. He's like, "Come on." And I'm like, and I go over there and I tap this guy, Peter, on the shoulder. And I'm like, "Chad wants to ask you something." And Chad says, "Will you be my temporary sponsor?" And Peter just blows up. "Temporary sponsors or temporary sobriety. I'll be your sponsor until we'll work together until we don't work together anymore. And you need to be at my house at Tuesday nights at 7:30 for a book study." And then he turns to me and he goes, "And you need to be there too." And I'm like, "Oh, I can't go on Tuesdays. I have group therapy." And he just blows up. And I decide that I'm going to go to group therapy on Tuesday. And I'm going to tell them that I want them to meet either earlier or later so that I can go to this book study with Peter at his house. And come to find out that Tuesday was the first. Do you guys know what an esophageal varices is? It's when the blood vessels burst in the esophagus. It kills 92% of alcoholics who experience the first time die from it. Peter ended up in the hospital with his very first esophageal varices. And I go to group therapy, Len, the guy with the card I told you about, and I'm the only one there. Everybody else had canceled group therapy. And I'm telling Len what's going on. And he says, "I think you're supposed to go to this book study." And I started going, and I finally asked that man to be my sponsor. These little, we call them God shots, right? And I'm in a meeting. I would go to this 1 o'clock meeting every day at Pathfinders. I could walk over there. I could take care of my clients. I could walk over. So I was going to the 1 o'clock meeting every day, Monday through Friday. And then I had 4 nighttime meetings that I was going to. I did that for the first 3 years of my sobriety. And there was somebody got up to share at the meeting, and they talked about how God's inside of us. You know, I've been looking out there for God. I've been, you know, and it says God as we understood him. And I've been trying to create God as I understand him. What is my God? And I'm not right in my 4th step. And I'm coming up on a year. One of my sobriety brothers says that if I don't get my 4th step done by the time I'm a year sober, Peter's going to call me out from the podium when he gives me my 1-year token at that Sunday morning men's meeting. And so I try to write my, and I go to Peter after the book study one night, and I'm like, "Oh, you know, I think God is punishing me because I'm not writing my 4th step. I wasn't getting what I wanted. Life was hard. Things didn't turn out the way I thought they should. I didn't get what I wanted, so life was hard. God is punishing me." And Peter whips around and he starts thumping my chest and he says, "God is kind, giving, loving, understanding. Wants to see me happy, joyous, and free. Doesn't tease me, doesn't test me." And in that instant, in that very moment, I switched my idea about what a higher power could look like. Now, fun part of that story is couple of years later, I'm at a men's meeting called the Mesa Men's, and I tell that story. Peter was from New York. His parents were in the Auschwitz-type places over in Germany, and I tell that story, and a couple of guys get called on to talk, and then Jeff Young gets called on to talk, and he comes up and he says, "Only in Alcoholics Anonymous can a Jew help a Mormon find a relationship with a higher God." Right? Because right in that incident, it's like, okay, higher power can look different, right? I get to choose. It says, God is, I understood him. One of the things that I've been looking at lately, and I Peter says, you got to go get a sponsees. You don't have time for people. You can't wait for people to come up and ask you. You got to get a card with your name on it. Go introduce yourself. My number one fear is being rejected. I'm a basic human being, okay? I don't want to be rejected. My number one fear is I'm afraid you're going to find out I'm stupid. I'm not afraid you're going to think I'm stupid. I'm afraid you're going to find out I'm stupid. I like to do things in high school like read the dictionary and go to school and use words that I know they wouldn't understand so that they wouldn't find out that I was stupid. When I was 10 in the fourth grade, they gave me an award for checking the most books out of the elementary school library. I had checked out 365 books during the school year. My teacher says, "Darwin, you didn't hand in your book reports." I said, "Well, you have people do book reports to prove to you that they read two books this year." She goes, "Yeah." And I'm like, "Well, you don't have to make me read. You just gave me an award for checking 365 books out of the library. Well, I can't pass you on to the fifth grade without a book reports being written." I said, "You explain that to my mom." And she thought she was going to get me over a barrel because, "Well, if you don't do written book reports, then you're going to have to stand up in front of the class." And I'm like, "Okay, I can do that. I'm a talker, especially if I'm talking about a book." Another piece of evidence that the rules don't apply to me. I spent my life doing that. And I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and they say, these are the rules, right? These are just a few. They say we don't have any rules here, right? Yeah, we do. Find a higher power. Step one, I can't. Step two, God can. Step three, choose. I've been able to come into I have... So me and my higher power, you guys. So recently because I've been in a book study every week of my sobriety. It's the only book I have ever studied. I hated school studying. It's the only book I have ever studied. I love reading that book, and I don't underline anything in my book because I know that I'm going to open that book up and I'm only going to read what I underlined. And I might miss something that I need to see. And so I read the book. And we're in our book study one night, one of my favorite. In the book it says, these men knew they must help another alcoholic if they would remain sober. That motive became secondary. And my head's going, secondary? What's secondary to happily working with another alcoholic? I'm like, oh my God. You know, it was transcended by the happiness they felt by giving themselves to others. And all I'm looking at, and one of the women in our book study says, it didn't promise me any happiness. And I'm like, oh yeah, honey, right here. Right here, and she goes, oh, motive. The motive changes. My actions don't change. My motive does. If I'm helping another alcoholic in order to stay sober, I don't get the full benefit of helping another alcoholic. If I'm helping another alcoholic because I can, because I have been uniquely fitted to help another alcoholic, then there's some peace, there's some happiness that I will get doing that. So again, in the big book, we're reading Bill's story, and it's where Bill says he turned his life and his will over to the care of God as he understood him then. And I'm like, oh. So I've been spending my time trying to figure out what this higher power needs to look like before I can turn my life and my will over to it. What if it just means then, that moment that I need to surrender, that moment in that day when they're not doing it right, when I need to go tell that secretary that she's messing up my meeting, what if I just like surrender then to the God, the higher power of my understanding at that moment? That I don't have to have this perfect picture, idea, structure of what a higher power looks like. Just that I have one that I can trust, that I can surrender myself to, which is really hard. For me to let go of crap and like say God's in charge. Oh, I think I'll turn it over to God. That's kind of arrogant. I think God already has it. So, I'm about done, you guys. This has been, my friend Mark. I met Mark 21 years ago. And I understand that one of the meetings just had an anniversary for August. And so I met him in the spring, 21 years ago. And I can remember him sitting there talking. We're talking about meetings and the kind of meetings that we like to go to and the kind of meeting that he wanted to start. And I'm 1.5 years sober when I get to, we've had this relationship ever since. I get to see him at these retreats. He's now my sobriety brother. Where's Reuben? There he is. Reuben comes down and shows up at my Wednesday night book study and shows up at my Thursday night home group. So these people that I've met in Alcoholics Anonymous that I've known for 20 years. Up until I got sober, my longest relationships were my siblings. And some of them I don't really like. What time is it? I've got an older sister. Like everybody wants to make alcohol. A lot of people that I talk to, my selfishness and my self-centeredness, that's my alcoholism. No, that's my humanity. Human beings are selfish and self-centered. My drinking makes me not care that I'm selfish and self-centered. My older sister, when my mom died, my little sister had left her home and moved to where my mother was with my older sister. And my mother died just before Thanksgiving. On Thanksgiving, my older sister called her little sister and said, I don't want you at my house on Thanksgiving. I want to spend it with my family. And then she did it again on Christmas. She tried drinking once and she hated it. If that kind of selfish and self-centeredness made us alcoholics, she should be drinking because she sure needs one. You've been a very welcoming, you've been a very friendly, just a good group of people. Thank you.